content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And first today, The Trouble with Bad Bunny's Puerto Rico Takeover. This was written by Valerie Trapp. Since at least the 11th century in Europe, when troubadour musicians crisscrossed the continent singing songs of love and chivalry, one thing has remained fairly consistent. The artist travels. The audience stays put. Of course, there have been exceptions in which fans made pilgrimages to see their favorite musicians live. Thousands descended on Woodstock in 1969, and thousands more still attend Coachella and other festivals. Surging numbers of people have also in recent years been participating in, quote, concert tourism, end quote, hopping flights to catch touring artists such as Taylor Swift in other cities where tickets might be cheaper. The Puerto Rican artist Bad Bunny's residency in San Juan, titled No Me Quiero Ir de Aquí, I Don't Want to Leave Here, although, felt like a fresh proposition, not a tour or festival, but an intentional invitation for fans to come directly to his doorstep for repeated performances in the same place. Bad Bunny plans to tour his latest album, Debe Tear Mas Fotos, starting later this year. He's notably skipping any concert dates in the continental United States, in part because of his worry that, with a high number of Latinas expected at his shows, ICE could be outside, as he put it in one interview. But first, he decided to camp out at the El Choli Arena in Puerto Rico for 10 weeks this summer, performing tracks from across his entire repertoire. Droves of fans visited Puerto Rico for the shows. Their decision to travel to the island feels different from, say, choosing to see Taylor Swift in Amsterdam or Bruno Mars on the Vegas Strip, choices that might be more about the concert itself than the location. Combining a vacation and a Bad Bunny concert was an enticing opportunity for many devotees who hope to soak up the island that's so central to his artistic identity. When I visited San Juan to see one of the shows last month, I spoke with attendees who'd flown in from locations such as Florida, New Jersey, and Ohio, as well as from other countries such as Colombia. I heard a common sentiment that watching a musician in his own element, as he wanted them to, sounded like a one-of-a-kind escapade. Call it a new brand of concert tourism, a hyper-immersive live music experience on an artist's home turf, akin to a pop-up shop on steroids. During the residency, fans could take pictures where Bad Bunny bagged groceries before finding fame. They could swim in the beaches he sings about, see the foliage from his latest album cover in full bloom, and go to a quasi-museum of Bad Bunny paraphernalia at a San Juan mall, replete with behind-the-scenes lore and exorbitantly priced merchandise. Yet Bad Bunny's decision to host his shows in San Juan also had an uneasy layer of irony baked into it. By dubbing the event I Don't Want to Leave, he also necessarily meant you all have to come here. This travel prerequisite entails complexity for a place like Puerto Rico, which is already struggling with water shortages, the aftermath of Hurricane Aaron, and rising housing prices due in part to the development of luxury rentals for tourists. Tourism reportedly accounts for about 2% of Puerto Rico's GDP, although other figures suggest its contributions could be even higher. Real estate and rentals are also billed as the second largest contributor to Puerto Rico's economy at 19%. Puerto Rico is just one of many places, among them Hawaii, Portugal, and the Dominican Republic, that are caught in a tourism trade-off, weighing the economic benefits and jobs that the industry can bring against its possible threats to cultural preservation, the environment, and housing markets, among other concerns. Bad Bunny is clearly aware of this tension. In his music, he often sings about tourism with a compassionate but critical eye, as in the song Turista, in which he compares a lover to a vacationer who only saw the best of me and not how I was suffering. And although his residency drew in roughly 600,000 people from outside of Puerto Rico this summer, he reserved the first 3 weeks of his shows exclusively for Puerto Rico residents. Concertgoers from outside the island could only attend later. This week he also announced a surprise final performance for tonight. Only fans living in Puerto Rico can go in person, although it will be live-streamed worldwide. That the residency offered a cultural getaway as an add-on experience for his fandom, however, reveals the trickiness of combining art with tourism. The show I attended began when a torrential downpour ended. I arrived at El Choli early. People adjusted their pava hats and clip-on Flor de Maga flowers, Puerto Rican symbols that made up the evening's implicit dress code. On the stage screens, a slideshow of facts about Puerto Rican history played. Tidbits about Tejano history figures like Aguibana, and reminders of the island's independence movement. The arena was thick with a sense of local pride. One writer for the Puerto Rican newspaper El Vocero described Bad Bunny's show as the work of a modern-day saint, exercising from the Puerto Rican collective body the demons of cynicism, fear of the future, cultural apathy, and the toxic idea that what's ours, what's Puerto Rican, is less valuable. Puerto Ricans had plenty of reasons to feel cynical in recent years. Hurricane Maria devastated the island in 2017, killing nearly 3,000 people there. And 8 years later, some locals are still recovering. As a U.S. territory, the island lacks economic sovereignty. The island's budget is managed by an unelected board that many Puerto Ricans have nicknamed La Junta, made up of seven people appointed and fired by the U.S. president at will. In 2023, almost 42% of Puerto Ricans live below the federal poverty line. And, as Bad Bunny himself has often noted, a major concern for many Puerto Ricans is gentrification, fueled by tax incentives and the island's reputation as a cryptocurrency haven that prioritizes foreign investments over locals. As wealthy individuals, including celebrities such as Logan Paul, move to the island or buy up properties to develop into Airbnbs, housing prices have soared. A family member of mine who lives in the region of Isabela told me that many of his Puerto Rican neighbors have relocated, their homes sold to mainland Americans. Against this backdrop, numerous stories have interpreted Bad Bunny's residency as a salve for Puerto Rico's wounds, noting that the shows were expected to inject $250 million into the island's economy. Yet one Puerto Rican couple from San Juan that I spoke with at the concert, Garvin Sierra and Odalis Gomez, were skeptical that this spending would be anything more than a temporary boon. The concerts would create an economic boost this summer, they conceded, but this will later go away and a void will return, Sierra told me. Sierra also worried that the residency might merely encourage more people to move to the island, as some concertgoers have mused about doing in interviews. That would feed into Puerto Rico's existing housing crisis, Sierra argued, especially if the current tax incentives remain. The residency's reliance on tourism poses more obvious potential issues. Any financial boom achieved through tourism could come with a caveat. One United Nations site reports that only about 20% of all tourism spending in the Caribbean actually stays in the region. Through a process known as tourism leakage, travelers' dollars end up benefiting foreign-owned businesses, such as airlines, short-term rental owners, and major hotel chains, more than locals. Many concertgoers also relied on Airbnbs, which sat awkwardly with the themes of Bad Bunny's latest album. In his music video for Turista, for instance, the artist cleans up after a messy group of backpackers in what's ostensibly a vacation rental. Of course, fans aren't to blame for tourism's potential drawbacks based on where they choose to sleep. Full disclosure, I was able to stay at a relative's apartment in San Juan for the concert, but had this option not been available, I likely would have stayed at a rental or hotel too. Any critique of tourism might be better served by focusing on government policies rather than individual travelers, as Bad Bunny sings of a vacationer who's turned a blind eye to the island's troubles. It wasn't your place to heal them. You came to have a good time, and we had a good time. Still, as a column in El Vocero put it, there's a difference between culture as celebration and culture as transformation. Bad Bunny may sing about the island's trials, but the writer Pedro Blanco argued, the real question isn't what Benito does with his platform. Bad Bunny's real name is Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio. It's what we do with the energy that his music and spectacle generates. In the meantime, waves of fans continue to pour into San Juan's airport as the summer waned. When I stepped out of El Choli after the show I attended, I could already see the next plane slicing through a cloudy sky, ready to deliver a fresh batch of admirers to Bad Bunny's beloved Puerto Rico. Our second story, America is on the cusp of a two-tier vaccine system, written by Nicholas Florco. As far as sticker price goes, the recommended vaccines for kids in the United States do not come cheap. The hepatitis B shot, given within the first few hours of life, can be purchased for about $30. The rotavirus vaccine costs $102 to $147 a dose. A full course of the vaccine that protects against pneumonia and meningitis runs about $1,000. Virtually all children receive these shots for free. The federal government legally requires most insurance to cover the roughly 30 different shots for kids without a copay. Kids who are in Medicaid or who don't have insurance coverage can get free shots as well, thanks to a CDC program known as Vaccines for Children. Among public health experts, VFC, as it's commonly known, is widely seen as an unmitigated success. After the program was created in 1994, disease went down and life was a lot simpler for the families, Anne Schuchat, a former CDC official, told me. Roughly half of American children are eligible to receive vaccines through VFC. That practice and simplicity may be about to change. This week, the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, which guides America's vaccine policy, convened for just the second time since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired the entire panel and appointed new members, some of whom lack vaccine expertise or have expressed anti-vaccine views, or both. The meeting was chaotic, contentious, and plagued by indecision, but the votes it got through are starting to point toward shifting more fractured landscapes for kids' access to vaccines. ACIP voted to remove the joint measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, or MMRV vaccine from the childhood immunization schedule for children under 4, and instead recommended that kids get two separate shots, one for measles, mumps, and rubella, and another for varicella. This morning, the panel also voted to remove the combination shot from the VFC program. Both votes were motivated by a concern about the safety of the vaccine, including an elevated risk of febrile seizures. As the CDC website points out, these seizures can be stressful for families, though most children fully recover. The effect of the move away from the combination vaccine will be limited because most children in America already receive the separate shots. However, one group would bear the brunt of the changes more than others, children on VFC. Some parents opt for the convenience of a single shot, and those who are covered by private insurance may still be able to get it. Although private insurers will no longer be required to cover the joint MMRV vaccine for free, they are already pledging to continue with business as usual. On Tuesday, AHIP, a lobbying group that represents the health insurance industry, announced that its members will continue to cover shots under the pre-ACIP vaccine schedule until the end of 2026. A spokesperson for AHIP declined to comment on what happens after that. Parents could, hypothetically, also pay for these vaccines out of pocket. The disproportionately poor children covered by VFC do not have the same kind of wiggle room. What shots they can get for free from the program and when are directly tied to ACIP's recommendations. A Department of Health and Human Services spokesperson told me that the move will not increase vaccine inequality, but did not explain further. Mainly the changes that ACIP is currently considering would create inconsistencies for poor families. More trips to the doctor, more needle pricks. But as my colleagues Tom Bartlett and Catherine J. Wu wrote yesterday, the change to the MMRV policy, while minor, can send the message that vaccines are dispensable. The committee also discussed delaying when kids should get the hepatitis B shot, but ultimately decided to table an anticipated vote on whether they would recommend the delay. Kennedy has intimated that the hepatitis V vaccine may cause autism, despite the lack of data showing a link between the two. If the hepatitis B vaccine or another shot is removed entirely from the schedule, that will immediately hit kids served by VFC. Beyond potentially serious disparities, more alterations, to childhood vaccines would likely cause more confusion. Kennedy's recent changes to COVID vaccine policy, which narrowed the approval for COVID shots so that they are recommended only for people over 65 or who have certain underlying conditions, left many Americans unsure about if and how they would get one. Americans who rely on VFC may soon have to similarly figure out what shots they can get and where. The confusion over COVID shots is a small glimpse of what may happen if ACIP moves forward with changes to the childhood vaccine schedule, Shushat told me. In the event that a vaccine is removed from the schedule, the experts I spoke with remain hopeful that some entity, such as a state health department, a community health center, or philanthropy, would step in to provide uninsured kids with free shots. But who or what, beside the federal government, could provide vaccines at the necessary scale is an open question. It's going to require some sort of extraordinary effort to provide that access, Richard Hughes IV, a professional lecturer in law at George Washington University Law School, told me. VFC works so well not only because it provides vaccines free of charge, but also because it is designed to ensure that doctors always have a supply of vaccines on hand. The CDC purchases vaccines and then provides them for free to doctors, who then dole them out to children in need. Medicaid could still provide some backstop for the poorest children, experts told me, but a likely scenario seems to be a system in which private insurers continue to cover vaccines while poor children are left behind. Such a scenario is the definition of healthcare disparity, Christoph Diasso, a pediatrician in North Carolina, told me. America has seen this type of vaccine inequality before. Beginning in 1989, measles tore through several cities, including Los Angeles, Houston, and Chicago, precisely because many low-income children were unable to access the vaccine. A big part of the problem was kids were in the doctor's office, but because they weren't insured, the doctors were referring the family to the health department, Shu Shat told me. That extra visit was something that was not easy for parents to find the time to get to. Researchers estimated that non-white preschoolers were 7 to 10 times more likely to contract the virus than white children. If it was this outbreak that led to the formation of the VFC program in the first place. In his time as Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kennedy has claimed that reforms to Medicaid would improve the program, despite projections from the Congressional Budget Office that the change would kick millions off of the safety net program. He has decimated minority health offices in his department in the name of government efficiency. And he has said that vaccine changes will be made in line with the latest science, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Now, in the name of following the science, Kennedy is on the cusp of creating a two-tiered vaccine system. Our third story. Nexstar and Sinclair lost their game of chicken. Written by James Surowiecki. When ABC pulled Jimmy Kimmel off the air last week after his comments about Charlie Kirk's assassination, the obvious way to understand the story was it was an attack on free speech. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Brendan Carr had, after all, publicly declared that ABC could do things the easy way or the hard way with regard to Kimmel, and then implied that local ABC affiliates might face fines or license revocation if nothing was done. Yet Kimmel's suspension also reflected something else, a flex by the broadcast media companies Nexstar and Sinclair, which over the past two decades have acquired hundreds of local TV stations and together own roughly 20% of all ABC affiliates. Within hours of Carr's comments, Nexstar and Sinclair announced that they would be taking Jimmy Kimmel Live off the air. Not long after, ABC said that it was suspending the show indefinitely. Local TV stations used to be owned by small independent companies or by the networks themselves. But today, about 40% of all local stations are owned by the three biggest broadcast station groups, Nexstar, Sinclair, and Gray. That consolidation has given them more leverage over the networks than local stations once had. So when ABC has ceded to their desire to take Kimmel off the air, it might well have seemed to them like evidence that the balance of power had shifted permanently in their favor. They were, however, wrong. When ABC brought Kimmel back this week, both Nexstar and Sinclair refused to air the show and put on local programming instead. In doing so, they effectively chose to play a game of chicken with ABC. And yesterday, both Sinclair and Nexstar admitted defeat in that game and put Kimmel's show back on the air. Broadcast station groups may be far more powerful than they once were, but in the end, the network remains the boss. A look at the economics of the standoff helps explain why. Although losing potential Kimmel viewers in the markets served by Sinclair and Nexstar put ABC in a tight spot with advertisers that expect a minimum number of viewers, the boycott was more costly to the broadcast stations, which have drawn many fewer viewers this week with their replacement programming, typically more local news, which they'd had to pay to produce, than they would have with Kimmel, particularly now when millions more people are tuning in as a result of the controversy. Late-night TV shows are far less popular than they used to be. But Kimmel still pulls in 1.6 million viewers on an average night, and according to the ad spot provider iSpot, has generated $70 million in ad revenue this year. Sinclair and Nexstar may be potent media players, but they would have run into serious problems if they had preempted Kimmel's show for an extended period of time. The terms of the contracts that affiliates sign with the networks are confidential, but they typically limit the number of times a station can refuse to air a network show. When a station violates its contract, a network can inflict both financial penalties and other problems by denying the station some of its programming. In ABC's case, the most dire threat would have been to pull college football and Monday Night Football from Sinclair and Nexstar stations. That would be painful to the local stations. Football is perhaps the most valuable property they have. You can't watch Oklahoma-Texas on our station this Saturday because we think it's more important to not show our viewers Jimmy Kimmel, was not a message that was going to win over viewers, even conservative ones. Worse, if viewers hadn't been able to watch college football on their local ABC station, they could have always tuned into Disney's ESPN app. Viewers who couldn't watch Kimmel on their local ABC station this week were able to find him on DirecTV, Disney Plus, and Hulu. The longer the standoff continued, in other words, the more incentive viewers would have to seek out alternatives, and the clearer it would have become that they don't actually need to watch broadcast TV to watch most of what's on traditional TV. In that sense, the controversy risked accelerating the already inevitable move from broadcast to cable to streaming, and that would obviously have been more costly to Sinclair and Nexstar than to Disney, because Disney collects the revenue from its streaming services. When the stations continue to boycott this week, then, they turned a successful bluff into an overplayed hand, something they seem to have realized after only a few days. Whatever the benefits of appeasing the FCC and Donald Trump, the costs of rejecting Kimmel were soon going to be dwarfed by the costs of losing viewers. So they caved, called it a victory, and put the show back on the air. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.